particles, the cosmic particles are being produced near the horizon of black hole. So if you believe that the theory is local, it's not very clear how the information of the matter which produces the black hole, how it is transmitted to the point where the particles are being produced, if we assume that there is nothing on the horizon. So the question is, how is the information transferred outside and in the theory which is local? So the information paradox, in some sense, is a tension between the following principles of in physics: unitarity, locality, and the equivalence principle. Or in other words, the assumption that the horizon is a smooth region of space-time. And the question is whether we, in order to resolve the paradox, we need to give up any of these principles in a drastic way, or whether we can reconcile them by including, allowing for small corrections to any of them. So, during my talk, I'm trying to argue that the answer is yes, that by allowing small corrections to locality, so by allowing very small non-locality, it is possible to resolve this tension between the previous principles and resolve the information paradox without sacrificing the simplicity of the horizon. But not everyone agrees with this, and there have been many several proposals which propose to modify the interior of the black hole in a very drastic way. In particular, there's this Fasman proposal, which was initiated by Mathieu some time ago. And more recently, there have been many discussions about the Firewall proposal after the paper of Almeri, Monaro, Polsinski, and Sully. And both of these proposals suggest that the interior of the black hole is not described by the usual Schwarzschild solution, but is replaced by something else. And in particular, any falling observer crossing the horizon will notice significant deviations from GR, or even like burn up at the horizon. So the main question I want to address is what happens to the incoming observer when he crosses the horizon? Does he feel something beyond what GR predicts or not? And I'm trying to address this question in the framework of ADS-FT. So I will consider black hole in ADS and try to understand the answer to the following questions. First of all, is the region behind the horizon encoded in the boundary CFT? Second, if so, then can we understand what happens to the observer falling into a black hole? And finally, what does this mean about the information paradox? So to be a bit more precise about my setup, we will consider ADS space, and we will imagine starting with some pure state, which undergoes gravitational collapse and forms a big black hole in ADS. And then we wait long enough for the black hole to settle down, and we throw in an observer after a long time. And this observer, here we see the world line of the observer, and performs local experiments in his frame, which are denoted by these blue crosses on the diagram. For example, this observer may measure local correlation functions, and we will try to understand whether these correlation functions are close to what is predicted by GR or not. So if we find that these correlation functions are very close to those of semi-classical GR, the conclusion would be that nothing dramatic happens to the horizon. So now the reason that this is not very easy is that in ADS-FT we know very well how to relate the analog of S-matrix elements in ADS to correlate functions in the CFT, but it's not so clear how to relate local bulk correlation functions to some kind of pointing in the boundary. So the first step of my talk will be to try to understand this question: how exactly we can describe local bulk observables from the point of view of the CFT. Of course, this is an old question. It has been studied a lot in the past, and I'm basically reviewing the work of several other people. And near the end, I would explain what we have added to the story by understanding how to push this construction behind the horizon of the black hole. Now, sometimes it is, often you hear that it's very difficult to understand locality from the point of view of a boundary, but this is not entirely true at large end. Because at large n, we have an exact mapping between the Hilbert space of perturbative excitations in gravity and the Hilbert space of excitations around the black hole of the Gibbs theory. And we can really map states in a one-to-one fashion. And if you can do that, then it's not difficult to write down the analog of local bulk fields from the point of view of the boundary. Because what you need to identify is what are the creation and annihilation operators which create particles. And then you have to multiply them with the right wave functions. So let me explain how this works. So the CFTs that we encounter in ADS-FT have the property that they contain these operators. For example, you can think of them as single trace operators. So these are operators with the property that their correlators factorize at large n. And even though they're not free fields, they're not ordinary free fields, so these are composed operators. And the fact that they're correlated factorized means that, in some sense, the excitation that you create by acting with these operators behave like a freely generated Fock space of particles. And we try to show that this freely generated gas is exactly the same as the gas of particles in ADS, ordinary particles in ADS. To do it more precisely, we start with some like single trace operator O, and we define its Fourier modes by Fourier transforming it along the boundary. And then from knowing the two-point function, which fits the conformal invariance, we can prove that half of these operators behave like annihilation operators on the vacuum. And you can also calculate the commutator between these modes using a larger factorization. And you can show that they're basically, they have the same form as ordinary oscillator commutation relations. So they behave like raising and lowering operators, even though the normalization is slightly unconventional. And this is supposed to be true as an operator equation, as long as we're at large n. And from this, we can conclude that by acting with these O's, we generate a Fock space of excitations, which is freely generated. And the important point here is that, unlike what happens for an ordinary free field, where you have some equation of motion and you have a dispersion relation between omega and k, these modes are not really free fields. They're like generalized free fields. So there's no absolutely no relation between omega and k. So omega and k are independent, which means that you have one additional free, let's say, momentum or frequency at your disposal, and which makes it possible to identify these excitations with excitations living in a higher dimensional space. So if you try to do the same thing for an ordinary free field on the boundary, of course, you can construct a Fock space, but there's no way you can identify that Fock space with a Fock space of higher dimensional theory. And so having identified what are the creation and annihilation operators, we can then proceed and multiply them with modes in the bulk. And to do that, we start with ADS in Poincaré, let's say in Poincaré coordinates, and consider a scalar field dual to the operator O. And if you solve the wave equation, you find a set of normalizable modes, which are can be identified in a natural way with a Fourier modes of the field O on the boundary. And you can put all of them together and write down this object, which is an operator in the CFT. So you can see that this operator, I have written explicitly CFT to emphasize that it is an operator acting on the Hilbert space of the CFT, even though it depends on Tx and one additional coordinate z. Because you can see on the right-hand side, what appears is this O, which is a boundary operator, it's a Fourier mode of the boundary operator, multiplied by some function, C number. So there's no operator on the bulk on the right-hand side. So this is really an operator acting in the CFT, but it is parameterized by the boundary coordinates together with an additional coordinate, which looks like an auxiliary coordinate from this point of view. However, by construction, we can say that if you think of these coordinates together as an anti-de Sitter space, where z is the radial direction in ADS, you can check that this operator satisfies a Klein-Gordon equation in this space and also behaves like a local field with respect to the ADS metric on this auxiliary ADS space. Are there any questions about this? Okay, so the point is that from the point of view of the CFT, this coordinate z is in some sense an auxiliary parameter which controls the choice of these wave functions. So it basically controls the smearing of the operator on the boundary. And as long as we're at large n, we can really see the relation between the size of the smearing and the depth in ADS. And in some sense, we can understand the causal structure of ADS from the point of view of the boundary.
Sorry, where can I see a smearing in the formula that you?
Yeah. Show? So the point is that I have I have Fourier transformed this O. Mm-hmm. These are the Fourier modes. And then I multiply it with some other wave function which depend on O. On omega and k. Mm-hmm. Another way to say it is that if you want, you can undo the Fourier transform and rewrite this expression in this form. It's a complete equivalent mathematically, right? But here you can see that I can write the field phi at point t and x as a non-local integral over t prime and x prime of the boundary field, convoluted with some kernel, k, which you get by doing this Fourier transform. And this object is usually called the transfer function. It's not the bulk-to-boundary propagator, it's another object. And it has this property that as you move the particle deeper into ADS, it spreads out on boundary. So you can write the bulk fields in this way using the boundary modes and sorry the boundary fields and this kernel, and this construction works very nicely at large n. However, there are many subtleties when we start to consider the one-over-n expansion. You have to make sure that locality is preserved ordered by order 1/n, and people have recently shown that this can be achieved by redefining this operator with the addition of multi-trace operators. So I think it's natural to expect that this prescription can be corrected in a perturbative sense in 1/n. And there are other subtleties. For example, how do we deal with gauge invariance the moment that we include dynamical gravity in the bulk? When we include 1/n corrections, we have to define observables in gravity which are gauge invariant in a sense. And also notice that so far I haven't said anything about strong coupling. So I could have done the same thing at small toft coupling at large n in the n equals 4 spillion mils, where we expect that the bulk theory is like string field theory of some sort. And then it's not very clear what is the meaning of this field. However, all of these subtleties have nothing to do with the black hole. These are questions that you would ask even if you try to reconstruct empty ideas from the boundary. So I will assume that somehow these questions will be settled in the future, and I will not deal with them right now. And I will proceed with the question of how do we extend this construction in the case where we have a black hole. Are there any questions so far? Okay. So now let's include the black hole, and we want to consider a black hole which is formed by gravitational collapse. So we start with ADS, and at some time t naught, we throw in some matter into the CFT, and this matter undergoes gravitational collapse and forms a black hole. And then we want to throw in the observer. As you probably know, for certain questions, it is possible to approximate this black hole by the eternal black hole in ADS. So if you want to ask questions about the late time behavior of the infonic observer, for certain kinds of questions, it is okay to replace this black hole formed by gravitational collapse by the eternal black hole. And which we will do for part of the talk, but in the end, the operators that I will write down will have a meaning for the black hole formed by gravitational collapse. And to remind you, black hole formed by collapse in ADCFT has to be identified with a typical quark gluon plasma state in the gauge theory, so some kind of pure state psi, while the eternal black hole in ADS is identified with a thermal ensemble in the gauge theory. So first, I will explain how to reconstruct this part of the thermal ensemble, and then I will explain how it is extended to the black hole in a pure state. So if we want to study local operators in this part of the Penrose diagram, we need to understand the behavior of thermal correlators in the gauge theory. So I will consider the CFT at finite temperature, and we define operators at finite temperature and by this formula. And one assumption that I will use is that we have Lattice factorization even at finite temperature. So the, let's say, small endpoint function of correlators factorizes the product of two-point functions plus 1/n corrections. But of course, the two-point function in which they factorize is completely different from the two-point function that you have in empty ADS. In particular, it's very hard to calculate this quantity in any realistic gauge theory. And also, let me say that this factorization is not an absolute statement. It holds only under certain conditions. For example, you should not put too many of these operators. If you put the number of operators scales with n, or if the position of the insertions starts to scale with n, either at very large or small distances, the factorization may break down. So even though we can't really calculate this thermal two-point function, we can still say a few things about it based on general principles. So this two-point function of two scalar operators at finite temperature, well, it's a function of T and X. And you can prove that if you do an analytic continuation of this function in the complex T plane, you can find that it has it's meromorphic in the domain which I have indicated here. So it can have singularities or branch cuts along the, these lines, and these extend periodically with you know, at distance I beta in both directions. And the point is that these correlators factorize satisfy this important condition, which is that if you start with a correlator at some t and analytically continue it all the way down to t minus I beta, you get back the original correlator with an exchange in the order of the operators, which means that it satisfies this condition, which is called the KMS condition. And if you write it in a Fourier space, you find that it relates the Fourier mode of the two-point function at negative frequency to the Fourier mode at positive frequency by this formula. And these are supposed to be exact relations that hold in any quantum theory independent of the coupling. So now let's try to do the same thing as we did before, namely take this thermal state and look for excitations around the thermal state and try to construct local bulk fields using those excitations. So we take the boundary field, and again we Fourier transform it. And now we calculate the commutator of the Fourier modes, and well, we find again it has the form of they have the form of independent harmonic oscillators, where the normalization depends on the actual two-point function. So it depends on the Fourier transform of the two-point function. So we cannot really write this explicitly, but we know that it has this form. And you can check that if you redefine these poles in order to have canonical commutation relations. So if you divide by the square root of this quantity, and you define some oscillators operators O hat of omega and k, you can check that using this KMS condition, you can check that the effective occupation level of this oscillator, harmonic oscillators, is given by the usual Boltzmann occupation level. And well, this is not as trivial as it sounds in the sense that these are not really free fields. They're strongly interacting fields in the theory. And the idea is that we have the quark-gluon plasma of the Gies theory, and we have this global operators O. These are singly traced operators. And you can check that if you evaluate the correlation functions in the presence of the quark-gluon plasma, they behave like you know, an independent set of harmonic oscillators, which are not in the ground state, but rather in this thermally occupied state. And these modes will be identified with what is usually called the thermal atmosphere of the black hole. So in ADS, we will have this black hole. And when we quantize the field in the presence of the black hole, we find that all the modes are thermally occupied. So this is the boundary statement of the thermal atmosphere. So now let's continue. We take this black hole in ADS. We quantize the scalar field in the presence of a black hole. So we can take Klein-Gordon field, and we write down the ansatz of this form. So it's a plane wave along the boundary times some radial wave function. And you can check that for every value of omega and k, there is a unique solution. If you impose normalizable boundary conditions at the boundary of ADS. So we do not impose any boundary conditions at the horizon. So we do not impose ingoing or outgoing boundary conditions. And these modes will have will be a linear combination of ingoing and outgoing. These are the usual social modes that you would use if you try to quantize a field in the presence of a black hole. And it's very natural to identify this source of modes with the Fourier modes of the operator O on the boundary. And so we do the same thing as before.
Just one thing here.
Yeah.
As soon as you are doing this, aren't you more or less putting by hand that whatever you will get will be smooth? Because you are putting by hand that you will have a smooth match.
So far, I have not said anything about the horizon, right? Everything is before crossing the horizon.
But you are putting some smooth metric and finding some smooth solutions of Klein-Gordon, and then using conjecturing or postulating that there is a way of describing experiments in the bulk by convoluting with this wave function. This is a, it's not.
No, the point is that if you believe that, well, the point is that the correlator that you will calculate, well, I am assuming a DCFT, of course. I don't know if this is what you mean. I cannot.
You are assuming that the correlation function of two such phi CFTs is somehow related to some experiment in the bulk at two points in the bulk, right?
But, no, I'm not assuming anything about the interior. I'm assuming that the usual GKPW prescription, so I'm assuming that this two-point function of the boundary field is related to the boundary value of what you would calculate in the black hole in ADS. That I am assuming. But now I do not want to talk about correlators near the boundary, right? I want to push them in the interior. Yeah. So again, I assume that this two-point function is what you calculate from ADS15 by the usual prescription. That's an assumption. I cannot prove this statement.
Okay.
right? Now, using this assumption, I want to reconstruct local operators in gravity.
Well, but I mean, the problem is that you're writing a metric there, and so you're assuming that it exists inside and outside the horizon.
I haven't said anything about the interior yet.
But you, I saw your metric.
Yeah, but so far, as I will try to emphasize, these operators, these operators make sense only outside the horizon. When we try to go behind the horizon, we have to like more work. But well, okay. The point is that if I define for you some operators in the CFT, let me. So we pair up this bulk modes with a boundary and Fourier modes, and we define these operators again in the CFT. These are CFT operators, which are given by convoluting these boundary modes with this bulk wave function. And now I'm claiming that if you believe that the correlators of the of O with itself are the usual ones that you would calculate in any CFT, then the correlators of this phi will be the same as those that you would calculate on the background of a black hole. So I define a set of operators on the CFT whose correlators reproduce what you would naively calculate using semi-classical gravity. Do I need to do more than that?
This is a conjecture, right?
What is the conjecture? Which point do you mean the conjecture?
This is not valid when you take Z all the way.
To the horizon? No, we haven't said anything about that. So let's, for a moment, let's talk about points which are, let's say, some finite distance away from the horizon. Let's start with this question. How do we reconstruct this part of the geometry in the presence of the black hole where we are, I don't know, some finite distance away from the horizon? So I agree that I cannot prove everything, of course, but what I'm saying is that if you allow me to assume that the correlators of these O's, which are boundary correlators, are the same as those that you would calculate by the ZKPW prescription in the presence of a black hole. So I am assuming that ADCFT holds the usual sense. Then you can plug it back in and reconstruct an operator of the CFT, which can be identified with an operator which is not near the boundary, but rather in the interior of ADS.
This is the point, maybe I'm very confused. Yeah. But what I thought was that you find some operator phi CFT that has a plausible interpretation as a operator in the ball, but it could be that there is another map that would also have a plausible one, and so it's a conjecture to say that this operator is the way
to put an operator in the ball. If this is what you mean, then I agree. I cannot prove that this is the unique operator that I can reconstruct with these properties. But
by putting this one where you use these particular wave functions, aren't you putting by hand that whatever you are going to get next will be smooth because you are using smooth stuff to define your prescription of how you are going inside the ball?
You could have asked the same question about reconstructing empty ADAs, right? This doesn't have to do with the black hole by itself, right? You could have asked the same question when we were talking about reconstructing empty ADAs.
That's true.
Right? Yeah, so I can't like give you a satisfactory answer because I think to nail it down and really show that this is a unique way to do it, there's no way to do it apart from including the interactions, basically. So you really have to check how this prescription can be corrected in a perturbative sense in one over n. And only then, I think, you can prove the uniqueness of this prescription. But I think this question is not specific to the black hole, right? It's a question that we could have asked about empty ADS as well. Okay. So again, we define the operators in the CFT, and the wave functions that we're using are not the same as before, of course. These are the solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation in the presence of a black hole. And the claim is that if you take this operator and you calculate the Klein-Gordon equation on the black hole background, you find that it's satisfied, and these operators behave like local fields on the background of a black hole. So up to the subtleties that have to do with reconstructing the bulk from a boundary, I think that this is the most plausible guess for what is the local operator describing a point in the interior from the point of view of the boundary when you have a black hole. Now the question is what happens if you want to take this guy and push it behind the horizon? At first you might think that we can take this operator and somehow do an analytic continuation and take Z to go behind the horizon, but that's not right. And one way to see it is to look at the eternal black hole and notice that, a Cauchy slice for the entire space-time is a slice sigma 1 plus sigma 2. And so far, the modes that we have been using, these OOs, are basically the Fourier modes along sigma 1 only. And now if you look at the point behind the horizon, let's say the point P, you can see that if you want to reconstruct P and you look at the path of the causal path of this point, you intersect both sigma 1 and sigma 2. So it's not possible to write down a local something that behaves like a local operator at point P without using a new set of modes, which would play the role of the modes on slice sigma 2.
Can you go to global ABS and put a field on a sphere and use your modes there?
On a sphere? In global ABS, you mean?
Yeah.
No, this could be global ABS, right? This doesn't have to do with the boundary being Poincaré or global ABS. This is the other side of the horizon. It's a Kruskal extension, right? This is not a Poincaré horizon. If you try to do the, I don't know if this was your question. If you try to ask the same thing for, you can take the shift in the vacuum and try to see how you can take an operator and push it behind the Poincaré horizon. That's a separate question. In that case, it is true that you don't need any other modes. But the reason is that, well, if you draw the global ABS diagram, the Poincaré path is something like this. So if you draw a Cauchy slice of the Poincaré path, it really is a Cauchy slice of the entire space-time as well. So you're not missing any modes. But it's different in the case of the Kruskal extension of the black hole ABS. So in this case, you're really missing these modes from the point of view of the CFT living on this side. It seems like you're missing them.
But those are familiar with this picture, we made this free, but in higher dimension, you can go around.
Second?
Region 1 and 3 are really disconnected.
Well, they're connected by this wormhole. Is this what you mean? Or like by a space like that?
No,
you can't go around. No.
Well, I mean, in reality, you don't really have region 3. You have material that's forming, falling from the
black hole. Yeah, precisely.
And I guess the statement is that you need to know what that material is doing.
Precisely, yeah. So in reality, we don't have region 3, right? This is an idealization, a mathematical idealization. In reality, what we have is, this kind of situation, where this red thing is the material of the star. And what I call these modes here, that I am trying to identify now, I can also push them along this horizon, right? So I just need to know the modes that are coming out of this horizon. And in the picture of the star, these are modes that are coming, in some sense, from the surface of the star. And the point is that, if you wait for very long times, and if you throw in this guy very late, then these modes tend to have universal behavior. That's why we can effectively replace the collapsing black hole by the eternal black hole. The point is that I want to emphasize, though, is that just on a formal level, it's not possible to write down something that behaves like a local operator in region at point P using only one set of modes. You might think that, perhaps I can set these modes to their ground state or freeze them to be zero or something like that, but that will not work because you can always imagine an experiment where an observer falls in and when he's at point P, he can decide to create a pair of particles, one moving in one direction, the other in the other direction, and then you really need some modes coming from region 3 to describe the right inverse. So there's no way you can write down a local something that behaves like a local bulk operator using only one set of modes. So now the question is, as you pointed out, in gravity, these modes can be thought of as modes coming from the surface of the material. What is the analog statement from the CFT point of view? Now, there's also this other story, right, that the eternal black hole in ABS, according to Malathena, can be identified with two copies of the CFT in some specific entangled state. And in this case, it's pretty clear what is the meaning of the other modes, because in that case, the modes on this slice are the usual Fourier modes O, and the modes on the other slice are the Fourier modes of the corresponding boundary field on the other copy of the CFT. But this is not what we're going to do. We really want to consider a single CFT and understand what is the meaning of the operators O tilde from the point of view of a CFT in a pure state. So now the point is that even though the CFT is in a pure state, it can still look thermal, even though there's no heat path. So intuitively, this happens all the time, right? If we start with a gas in this room and we put it in a little corner in some pure state, we say that after a long time, the gas will thermalize, fill up the room, and it will go into some kind of state which looks like a thermal state. So whenever we have a complicated enough system, then, and we start with some pure state, we intuitively expect that after a long time, the system thermalizes. Now, what does it mean precisely? It means that there are some observables that I will call Goldstein observables with a property that the correlators on this pure state psi approach the thermal correlators at late times. Now, clearly, this cannot be true for all observables, because even if you have this room and if you ask a very detailed question, like where is a specific molecule of a gas as a function of time, you have no reason to expect any kind of universality for this kind of question. So it's not true that all operators in your theory will have a property that they will thermalize. And that's why how we can divide the observables in the theory into what we call coarse grain and what we can call fine grain observables. But to give a more concrete example, in the Gears theory, coarse grain observables would be a correlation function of single trace operators. And we know that if you take like a small number of single trace operators, you can prove that if you evaluate the correlator on a typical pure state psi, the answer will be very close to what you would calculate in the thermal ensemble. That follows from large unfactorization at finite temperatures. So there are in the Gibbs theory, there are some observables with this property that even though we're in a typical pure state psi, it seems like the correlators are given by the thermal ensemble. And I repeat, this is what we call from now on coarse grain observables. And I will now try to argue that whenever you have the situation, the coarse grain observables are effectively doubled inside the space of the fine grain observables. Now, I will make a simplifying assumption, which is not literally true. I will just assume that when you start with I will assume that the Hilbert space of the theory can be thought of as a direct product of what you get by acting with the coarse grain observables and what you get by acting with fine grain observables. Now, clearly, this is not true in the n equals 4. I mean, the Hilbert space of n equals 4 does not have a direct product structure. And so the more precise statement, which can be, I can explain later if you want, is that if you look at a specific pure state psi and you look at small excitations around the state psi, then you can think of these excitations that are taking values in this kind of Hilbert space. And now the point is that, but just for the sake of simplicity, let's assume that we have this situation where we have a small part of the system on which the coarse grain observables act times a bigger part of the system where the fine grain observables act. Now, in this situation, we start from some pure state psi, and we realize that the system thermalizes after time evolution. And the point is that in this case, the fine grain degrees of freedom play the role of the heat bath for the coarse grain degrees of freedom. So in the case of the Gibbs theory, this would be like represent quark gluon plasma microstates, while this this part would represent the ordinary single trace operators, the global operators. And now we try to argue that when we have a situation then of a small system in contact in some kind of equilibrium with a bigger heat path, then the small system is mirrored inside the heat path. And again, for us, the heat bath is played by the quark gluon plasma, and this small system is basically the correlation functions of single trace operators in the presence of the quark gluon plasma. And we try to argue that when we have the situation, then we can naturally define some new operators O tilde. I mean, for every single trace operator O, you can define an O tilde, which will eventually play the role of the mode on the other side of the horizon. Now, the point is that when you have this a case of two systems in some kind of equilibrium, you can take the pure state of psi and expand it in some basis of orthonormal states. It will be some entangled state, of course. So you will have this kind of structure. But what we do know is that if we calculate the reduced density matrix on the small subsystem, we expect that the density matrix will be very close to the thermal one. So if you trace out the fine grain degrees of freedom, you expect to get this type of density matrix for the small subsystem. And then you can combine this statement with the fact that whenever you have an entangled state between two systems, you can always go to a Smith basis and write it in the form sum I coarse and I fine, where these states are orthonormal. And
this Hamiltonian is a function of the state you're looking at. Or is it a universal Hamiltonian?
You mean this coarse grain Hamiltonian?
Yes.
That's a good question. In the gauge theory, in the gauge theory I have in mind, the idea would be that the Hamiltonian can be expressed as a sum over all this O, okay.
Maybe you want to use another board.
Oh, I'm sorry. So I remember I said that the coarse grain. Can I write here? Is it? So in this particular case, I said that the coarse, we should think of the coarse grain Hilbert space as the space which is generated by single trace operators. And I also explained that these operators, at large n, they look like you know, a gas of independent oscillators. So basically, this Hamiltonian can be written as sum of omega. It's the energy of every state times the occupation level for these other single trace operators. If you think a little bit, this is nothing else but the Hamiltonian that you would calculate from the bulk point of view in region one. It's the usual source of Hamiltonian in the bulk. Okay, so.
Can I just ask, since you paused there?
Sorry?
When you talk about coarse grain observables, you're really talking about a kind of operator, is that right? Like your favorite blue ball operator. So, but I think you also would agree that if I took n squared of those operators.
Yeah, precisely. That's a very important point. That it's not very clear how, in what sense, this subsystem is closed in this particular case, okay. Right? Yeah, I mean, I agree.
Are you
going
to say more about that, or?
No, I don't have a good answer to it. I mean, we're still thinking about it. How exactly we can define this set? I can say that if you take order one set of these operators, order one number of these operators, then we can. Use all of our approximations. If you take order n squared of them, then clearly it doesn't make sense to think of them as coarse grain anymore, right?
Right.
Yeah. But the point is that if we want to reconstruct the infalling observer, we never need to talk about order n squared. I mean, when we throw in an infalling observer, there's no reason to take the mass of the observer to be comparable to n squared. We can throw in like a small observer.
Yeah, it's just the distinction between what's coarse grain and fine grain, though. What we're discussing now has nothing to do with the kind of operator, but you know, the number of operators you insert.
Yeah, I agree.
And so somehow talking about, well, it's a complementary part of the discussion.
Yeah, it's a very important question, but unfortunately, I don't have a good answer.
Yeah,
we're still thinking about it. Sure. Another related question is, if you look at the sum over omega, it's not, you have to be careful because in some sense it's divergent. And for instance, well, it's the usual divergence that we have when you calculate the entanglement entropy of you know, region one of a black hole. You have to either put some cutoff near the horizon, some stretch horizon perhaps, and then there's a good, like an important question, where exactly do you place this cutoff? So in the same sense, we have to regularize this Hamiltonian, this, the boundary version of this divergence that you find in the bulk. Again, we don't have a good answer.
I didn't quite understand your answer to the first question about the state dependence of this procedure.
So far, the coarse grain Hamiltonian is not state dependent.
You mean written as a function of these?
Yeah, so this O would be trace Z squared in the gauge theory. So in the gauge theory, this O is some single trace operator. So I can take this O to be, you know, trace F mu F mu, for example. I can then calculate the Fourier mode of this guy, and this defines this O of omega and k. And you can see that it's clearly a you know, state-independent operator.
Well, you're telling me that in this construction, it doesn't matter which pure state I start with, that will always identify the same subspace of the fine grain.
No. I'm only talking about the coarse grain Hamiltonian at the moment. So this Hamiltonian is a coarse grain, is a Hamiltonian acting on the coarse grain Hilbert space.
I guess the confusion that at some point you say that the separation between coarse and fine is like a fiber.
It's defined
over for a given state.
Yes.
So then I would expect the Hamiltonian this dependence also.
That was a question. Okay. Yeah, in this particular case, I think it will remember this dependence in the following sense. These guys that I wrote here are supposed to be the ones that normalize to behave like ordinary harmonic oscillator, to have a commutator which is one, not something else. And if you remember, this O hat, well, I went quite fast, but this O hat was related to the usual free mode of the boundary field by dividing with the square root of the boundary two-point function. Now, the boundary two-point function depends on beta. In particular, it depends on the mass of the black hole. So if you try to rewrite this equation in terms of the Fourier modes of the boundary field, you will get factors of g, which will introduce some dependence on the mass of the black hole, or in other words, on the temperature. So in that sense, it's not completely state independent, but it doesn't depend on the microstate. So for all black hole microstates of the same mass, I would say that the operator is the same. Okay, however, even though this operator is state independent, now we are coming to a point where we will introduce state dependent operators. And let me remind you where we were. We wrote down the full pure state as a direct, as an entangled state. And then we brought it into Smith form. And we could fix the size of these coefficients because we know that once you calculate the density matrix, we expect to get a thermal density matrix. And now we can see how we can effectively double our operators. Because for every operator acting on the A, acting on the coarse grain Hilbert space, I can take my operator A and write it as, you know, in terms of matrix elements. There's a natural way to define an operator A tilde acting on the coarse grain, fine grain Hilbert space, simply by taking the states which are entangled, well, in this decomposition, and using the same matrix elements.
What is a fine-grained operator? What's an example of one?
I cannot write it out explicitly. The point is that you would have to take a black hole microstate, which means you would have to take an operator of conformal dimension of order n squared.
Some determinant.
I don't know. Probably it's a generic order n squared operator. There are many, many, many of them, right?
Do you have to consider as many cores as fine-grained because you have this doubling?
Good. So the point is that in general, you have a lot more cores, fine-grained, right, obviously.
Right.
But the point is that the entanglement between the coarse grain and the fine-grained selects for you a specific subset of the fine-grained operators. And we pick that subset. Now, it's difficult to write it down explicitly in terms of traces and operators. But the point would be that take some very huge, complicated state of the n equals 4 PM reads, act on it with single trace operators to perturb it, and find the corresponding field operators by this construction. So anyway, so for any pure state psi, we can do this decomposition and define this operator A tilde, which are state dependent. So depending on the state psi, these guys will be different, of course. And then the point is that you can check that this set of A tildes have the property that they satisfy an isomorphic algebra to that of the A's. I mean, if you start with an algebra of coarse grain operators and you define the corresponding A tildes, you can check that the algebras are isomorphic. And the A is commutative with A tildes because they're acting on different Hilbert spaces. And moreover, you can check that the correlators of these O tildes agree with what you would calculate by doing this formal analytic continuation, which is what gives you the thermofield doubled correlators. So all in all, to summarize, by this construction, you define a new set of operators acting on the pure state that you started with a property that the correlators between A and A tildes are the same as the correlators that you would calculate using the usual thermofield doubling formalism for the gear theory. Which means you can naturally identify these operators with what plays the role of the modes on the other side of the black hole. Now, before I go on, let me emphasize that these operators have very special properties in the sense that they're fine-grained observables, which means that they're defined for every given microstate, they have different form. And moreover, if you take these fine-grained operators and you evaluate them on a different microstate, psi prime, you will get a complete nonsense. So the answer you will get will have nothing to do with what you would expect. So these are really operators that are defined to give nice correlators on the specific microstate for which they have been constructed. And as we said before, there are many fine-grained operators, and these tilde operators are selected by the entanglement with the coarse-grained operators. And mathematically, they have this property that they are very sparse operators. So they have very few non-zero eigenvalues. They only act on very few states. And as I will explain later, we think that this property is important in order to realize complementarity without violating locality in a very dramatic way. So I will come back to this point a bit later. Okay, so here we have the story again. We have this. We define this the analog of the bulk moson sigma 1 is basically the Fourier moson of the boundary field, and the moson sigma 2 is the O tildes, which were defined by this construction. And even though I'm using this picture, I'm actually referring to a black hole formed by gravitational collapse, right? I'm talking about operators defined on a pure state. Putting everything together, you can write down this expression, phi, which contains both O and O tilde, and where you multiply this O and O tilde by the solution of the Klein-Gordon equation in region 2 of the black hole. There are twice as many solutions in this region than 1 and 3, because there are no boundary conditions to satisfy.
But here, again, this is a big assumption.
Which
assumption
one?
That you can define, say, correlation functions on point P and another point P.
No, but I'm not assuming anything, right? Okay, I'm not assuming anything. I'm defining this operator.
Yeah, no, if it's the definition, and then if you want to ask whether correlation functions of this defined operator are smooth, okay, that's okay.
Are they smooth?
But then, I don't know. Probably. I mean, you'll probably.
Yeah. If you believe that they're smooth, then you can ask me, is this really the operator that corresponds to the, is that your question, to the interior of the hole?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, but that's somewhat
a
philosophical question, right? In the sense that if I define for you a set of operators in the CFT, whose correlation functions describe a smooth interior of some space-time, I mean, how can you kind of say that these are not really the right operators? I mean,
like they're an independent experiment, like, right? Someone could dive into the black hole and measure correlation functions and then ask whether it agrees or not with this prediction from this.
My understanding is that this observer that would like to throw into the black hole is basically an excitation of blue balls in the gauge theory, right? So it's something that you would some kind of excitation you would construct in the gauge theory. So if in the gauge theory there is some description available to this excitation, to this like observer, which looks simple, I think that this observer would naturally perceive this simple description. If I have a physical system and there is one way to write express the correlation functions in a very simple way that looks like semi-classical fields propagating on a weakly curved background, I see no reason why we should not really take this as a reality of what the uniform observer will measure.
I just want to understand whether it's a conjecture or whether it's a theorem.
It's obviously not a theorem.
Maybe a CFT conjecture, the fact that you can reconstruct a bulk from the boundary?
No, I mean, CFT is correct. I mean,
I'm saying if I'm interested in gravity, for me, he's trying to make precise ADS-CFT. That is a conjecture that if I know the boundary, in some sense, it describes the bulk. So usually, nobody tells you exactly what they mean by that. Here is
exactly
putting his hand up. But if you don't tell me how you can do it, then you can never prove the conjecture.
No, right.
Right.
Yeah,
so
I agree, yeah.
So that's the, he's doing, you know, the thing that, you know, I, you know, as a gravity guy, you want to see. Somebody telling you how.
No,
you
I agree. I'm not.
If we could actually show that this can be corrected in a perturbative sense in one over n, I think it would be very, it would be very natural to actually believe that this is indeed the interior of the black hole. So a valid criticism, I think, is that this is only true at infinite n, and I have very little control of what happens when I include one over n corrections. But if I was able to correct this procedure, like in some perturbative sense in one over n, then I think that in some sense we're entitled to identify this object with the with a semi-classical bulk field. Okay. From this point of view, if you believe this construction so far, it seems like there is a way to define a family of operators in the CFT, which are parameterized by something that looks like space-time points on a black hole background, whose correlators are the same as those that you would calculate by semi-classical gravity. So apart from these questions of whether this is indeed the reality of the infinite observer or not, I would say that the CFT gives you at least one description of that looks like an infinite observer falling through the horizon without experiencing anything dramatic. Let me come back to the, there are several subtleties, of course, about this splitting of the coarse and fine degrees of freedom, about one-over-n corrections, Another technical thing is that, in some sense, you might worry that this transfer function spreads out and extends all over the boundary once you approach the horizon, but actually that's not the case. And anyway, most of these subtleties you can kind of get around if you believe that the Larsen expansion of finite temperature holds in the usual sense. I can come back to these points if you want later, but let me try to finish by explaining how this is relevant for the information paradox. So we argue that the horizon is smooth, and these arguments of Maturin, this AMPS, Almeri, Maros, Polchinski, Sully, claim that frame fold cannot be compatible with unitary evaporation. And their argument was based on some kind of sharpened version of the information paradox, which is based on the Stone's relativity theorem. And I will try to explain now how our construction is related to this story. So there's a more like a simple version of the information paradox, which makes no reference to the interior of the black hole at all. And this is a version that I explained in the beginning, namely that you start with a pure state and you end up with a thermal state. How is it possible? And we know that the resolution to this version of the paradox is not very complicated, because this is also what happens when you have like a normal piece of like a piece of coal that burns. If you look at the photons that come out of this of the piece of coal, they will look approximately thermal, but in reality there are a very small entanglement between all the photons, which means that if you look at the full density matrix, it will look like almost a thermal density matrix plus very small corrections. But you can check yourself that these corrections, because you have a very large Hilbert space, they can conspire to unitarize the process. So if you only look at the outgoing radiation, it's not very difficult to understand how this approximately thermal computation of Hawking may be consistent with unitarity once you include small corrections. Now, these recent papers have emphasized a like, sharpened version of this paradox, which goes as follows. The idea is to look at the evaporation in some kind of stepwise fashion, where we think of the pairs as being produced one after the next. And here we see, we denote by A, the hot particles which have been produced a long time ago, and BC we call a newly created pair. So B is the outgoing hot particle and C is the infalling one. And now the point is that if we look at this radiation A, and in the beginning, when you have only a few number of these A's, it will look like thermal radiation without any correlation between the photons. So if you calculate the phenomenon entropy of this A in the beginning of the evaporation, it will be positive and it will keep increasing as you get more and more photons. So this is a standard result that if you look at a very big system and you start calculating the entanglement entropy of, the entropy of a small subsystem, in the beginning, the entropy increases with the size of the system until you reach roughly the half of the size of the total system, where the entropy starts to decrease. So if we do it for the black hole, if we apply this for the black hole which evaporates, then this is a prediction about the entropy of radiation A as a function of time. So at the beginning of the black hole evaporation, we expect that the entropy of the radiation will increase because we have no information in the radiation. And then after some point, which is defined as the phase time, the radiation starts to, the entropy starts to decrease. So this is what we expect if we want to restore unitarity during the black hole evaporation. Right? Now, the point is that, so in the beginning, whenever we have a new particle B produced and we put together with A, we expect that the entropy of S together, or A together with B is larger than the entropy of A. That's why the curve goes up. But if we want to restore unitarity, then after phase time, or for all black hole, we expect that SAB must be less than SA. And then the paradox is that when we look at this process, we have two different requirements which are in conflict. For information recovery, we want B to be entangled with A, while for free info through the horizon, B has to be entangled with C. And the reason is that if you look at the Hawking computation, these B and C are produced in a specific entangled state, so that the state looks like a vacuum locally. And then we have this claim that B is at the same time entangled with A and with C. And you could ask, is that possible in quantum mechanics? And the answer is, it's not possible. And there's a theorem which expresses this impossibility. And it's this called the Strong relativity theorem, which says that for three independent systems, A, B, and C, there's an inequality for the entropies. And if you if you look at the specific example, I explained that B and C must be in almost in a pure state, which means that SBC has to be almost zero. And at the same time, C by itself is some kind of mixed state. So SC is a positive number. And if you look at this equation, you find that SAB plus zero is greater than SA plus positive number, or SAB is greater than SA. Which means that even after page time, even for an old black hole, you would have that SAB is greater than SA, which is in conflict with what we need for to restore unitarity. So this is a paradox that, like the firewall paradox in a sense, and these people proposed, and Matula also, that the way out of this is to assume that SBC is not zero, and is, well, in some sense, the horizon is not smooth. So in our construction, the role of this C is played by these tilde operators. So these C's are fine-grained operators, which were defined via their entanglement with the coarse-grained operators. Now, if we look at the situation after page time, most of the entropy of the black hole is in the outgoing radiation. So if you think of these B's as operators which are as excitations which are thermalized and entangled with something, they are mostly entangled with A. This means that when you do this construction of the tilde operators, the tilde operators will actually act on A, because A plays the role of the heat bath. So the claim is that if you define this modes in the interior of the black hole as the modes which are entangled with B, it turns out that after page time, these modes are basically supported on the early radiation A. So in that sense, they seem to be some highly scrambled version of a small part of the radiation A. And if you believe the statement, then it's clear then that the systems A, B, and C are not independent anymore, because C is really a part of A, and then you cannot apply the strong superlativity theorem. Is this clear? Of course.
Sorry, what do you mean by systems are not independent? You mean that they are the same? I'm not quite sure what.
There's an overlap between the. I mean, this theorem applies in the case where the total Hilbert space can be thought of as a direct product of the Hilbert space of A times Hilbert space of B times Hilbert space of C.
Okay.
Right? If what you call by C is actually a subset of A, then obviously you cannot apply the theorem.
So you're saying C is a subset of A. So,
yeah.
So it's not an independent part of the space.
And this is in some sense also the original idea of complementarity, in the sense that what the Hilbert space on the interior of the black hole is not an independent Hilbert space, but it's a Hilbert space which has already appeared outside the black hole. And what I'm saying is that if you define the C using our tilde story, this comes out in some sense automatically. So of course this would be nice, and the question is whether it's consistent with locality or to what extent. Well, obviously, if I claim that this C is secretly supported on A, I'm violating locality, and the question is, am I violating it by a small amount or by a large amount? And of course, the hope is that you have a very large number of, I mean, the size of this Hilbert space is huge, is exponentially large. So the hope would be that if you look at a pairwise non-locality between simple observables on A and simple observables on C, those might be small, but once you sum over all of them, you might get like a significant amount. So the hope would be that we can, for any point P1 inside the horizon and P2 outside the horizon, the commutator between these two simple observations, like the volume of scalar field inside and outside, we would hope that this commutator is very small, even though C is part of A. Of course, at the same time, we have no reason to expect that if you consider a very complicated operator acting on the outside the horizon, you have no reason to expect that this commutator will be small. So this can be large. So coming back to our previous discussion, if you take order n squared of these O's, you have no reason to expect that they will commute with O tilde. And here is, I would come back to this comment I made, that it may be important, actually, that these observables with C are fine-grained observables, which means that they are sparse. They have very few non-zero eigenvalues. Because if you want to have a commutator between A and the scrambled version of A, it's much easier to achieve a small commutator if your operator phi c has very few non-zero matrix elements. Because if you try to do this kind of construction for a toy model where you take, for example, a spin chain and you take ordinary spin operators, and you try to define a scrambled version of the ordinary spins, and you try to estimate a commutator with the original spins, you find that those commutators are too large, they're order one. So that kind of toy model, where you take a coarse grain observable and you simply scramble it, doesn't really work. So it may really be important that these operators are fine-grained and sparse. Okay, let me also mention something about complementarity. So our point of view of complementarity is that we have a single Hilbert space, which can describe both the interior and the exterior of the black hole. And on this Hilbert space, we define operators acting on it. And some of these operators play the role of local fields inside the horizon. Other operators play the role of fields outside the horizon. And so in some sense, we have nowhere modified the principles of quantum mechanics, which means that when we talk about cloning, there's no possibility to get any kind of paradox that has to do with cloning. So even if you stay outside the black hole and you try to measure, there's a long list of thought experiments where the observer stays outside the black hole, collects the radiation, reconstructs a bit, and then dives back into the black hole to find the interior copy. But from our point of view, if an observer could do this kind of experiment, he would not encounter any paradox with cloning, but only with violations of locality and causality. So in that sense, it's not that the formalism breaks down, it's only that the space-time description for this observer might break down in this case. So let me summarize. The main points I try to make is that we can, at least at large end, we can construct these local bulk fields, both outside and inside the horizon. And to the extent that we believe this construction, we argue that the infinite observer does notice anything when it crosses the horizon of the black hole. And in particular, the interior of the black hole arises because the coarse grained observables outside the black hole are effectively doubled inside the fine grained observables by the entanglement. And about the information paradox, I try to argue that small corrections can restore unitarity. And in particular, the way that we can get around this strong selectivity argument is by noticing that the interior of the black hole is not really independent, but rather a highly scrambled version of a small part of A. And finally, we have not fully clarified this point, but the hope is that this whole story can be completed by allowing only a very small violation of locality. Yes?
This construction. By construction would agree with the standard physics outside of the black hole and will account for all the what would be degrees of freedom if you want to the observer to fall inside. But can you show that the physics inside the black hole is local?
To the extent that what do you mean by that? I mean my definition of this statement would be operational in the sense that if I could define some operator
in the two-point function,
yeah, this guy. That,
this is the definition of two operator. This is a description of the, this is just a map of the degrees of freedom. But does it give you some effective local description inside the black hole?
So, in order to answer your question, I would take this operator and calculate the commutator between two of these guys inside the black hole.
Inside the zero, yes.
Yeah, that's the zero, yes. You can do it, yes. So, at large end, it is local in that sense. Maybe I didn't emphasize it enough, but the correlators of this operator are precisely those that you would calculate by semi-classical gravity. So indeed, they are local inside the
digit.
So
black hole is not the only possible end state of a collapsing star. I mean, I can imagine a neutrino star that could emerge. And asymptotically outside the neutrino star, everything looks exactly the same as a black hole would. But if you try to approach the horizon, at some point you realize you get inside the star. So isn't that like the failure of the whole idea of CFD way of answering this? Because asymptotically they're identical in space-time.
I'm not sure they're completely identical. For example, if you calculate a two-point function at low frequencies, it will not be the same, right? Because you have some boundary conditions at the horizon.
Well, I guess if you talk about if in real space they are identical, but of course when you do Fourier transform, then you're going to mix different modes. So yeah, but I mean, in real space, if we talk about metric is identical.
The metric is identical, but I think the response of if you consider the propagation of a scalar in the presence of a black hole or in the presence of a star. Well, I'm not sure, but I have a feeling that, as I said, in Fourier space, you will say it differs, most likely, right, at low frequencies.
But I guess that's kind of my question, that, I mean, how would you, based on what you're doing, what would be different if it was a neutron star instead of a black hole? Because for that, we know that you don't have a horizon and you have something, non-analytic happens or something. So if you just... repeat all these steps, but for a space-time of neutral, ADS neutral.
Yeah, that's a good question, but I haven't thought about it. So, for example, first of all, I cannot define any entanglement in that case, right? Because I suppose, I don't know what kind of star, are you talking about a thermal star or a neutron star? If you're talking about a neutron star, like a cold neutron star, I would think that the state is pure by itself.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no significant entanglement between the exterior modes and the interior mode, right? So I would not be able to define the field operators in any reasonable sense. I mean, that's one immediate obstacle that I see.
Yeah. Okay.
Seems to me that there's something a bit strange about the idea of a state-dependent operator.
Mm-hmm.
I would have thought that if I jumped into a black hole and performed like a yes-no experiment, that that would be some sort of projection operator on the total Hilbert space. Seems like if it's, you know, operators already depend on states linearly, so if there's additional state dependence, it seems like you're really doing nonlinear quantum mechanics.
No, yeah,
like
well, I'm not really modifying the formulas of quantum mechanics, right? I'm just saying that, there is this operator which has, I agree, has a state dependence, right? But it doesn't mean that it's a nonlinear operator. I mean, you can really think of this index or whatever, this label of operator as an inert index. It doesn't have to. You don't have to say it, right?
That's not what we, yeah, I understand. That's not what we normally do when we
do quantum mechanics. But we never talk about fine-grained observers. Yeah.
It's I think the interpretation is.
Yeah, I agree, it's not clear, so I agree. I don't know any other example in physics where these fine-grained observables play any important role. However, I think that it may actually be important if you really want to be able to have very small commutators between operators in the interior and the exterior. Because as I said before, if you take, the mathematical statement is that these operators have very few non-zero eigenvalues, basically, right? So they're very sparse operators. So if you really define the interior operators as being coarse-grained operators, so operators which are the same on every state, you just evaluate them and you get almost the same answer, I think it's very difficult to reconcile locality of the exterior and the interior. Yeah.
So take one of your operators in the region three behind the right. It would be supported only on the fine grain operator.
Yes.
And in this kind of operator, you compute a correlation function and factorize. What happens if you will take them and Fourier transform it back to trying to Fourier transform back to position space, you will not be local?
I suppose it will be local.
They will be local?
You mean on the boundary? Like if you push them over to the boundary? Is that what you mean?
If you Fourier transform them back to position, not work with the W and K, but work with X and Y, but consider these ones that are supported on the fine grain operator that lives in region.
Yeah, I would think that they would be local.
But their correlation function is factorized, so they correspond to your definition of cross grain.
No, the definition of coarse-grained operators was not, it was that they factorize on every possible state. These guys will factorize only on this specific state with respect to which they were defined. So there's a set of coarse-grained operators which have the property that on every state, almost every state, they factorize. These are nice operators. They factorize on almost every state. Now take a specific state, fix the state, and take these coarse-grained operators and look how they're entangling with the other guys. This picks for you a specific set of fine-grained operators which have the property that on that specific state, they also factorize. However, these fine-grained operators do not factorize on any different microstate. You have to redefine them.
prefinished?
Oh yeah,